talked to Junior on the phone till he died. He just kept saying, "Grandpa, he said, come get me. He said, come and get me. The fire's coming in the back door. Come on, Grandpa."
The tragedy of a grieving grandfather talking about losing family members in California's car fire on KCRA-TV. It's the latest firestorm to burn through an American city. Science is connecting bigger, more destructive wildfires in our warmer climate. So how are climate scientists processing this new reality on the ground they've been predicting for decades? I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. This is ClimateCast. The science is clear. A hotter climate favors larger wildfires. Noah Diffenbaugh is an Earth Systems Science professor at Stanford University. His work is finding climate change fingerprints in individual extreme weather events. I talked to him via Skype about links between drought, heat waves, wildfires, and floods.
So wildfire always results from a confluence of ingredients. Certainly it takes ignition, whether that's from lightning or from a campfire, a cigarette, a spark from a car. We're also certainly seeing that as, you know, we continue to expand our footprint. You know, we're building in areas that are right at the interface of the wildland, urban wildland interface. So we're certainly exposed to wildfires. But it's also clear that, the dryness of the vegetation contributes to the wildfire risk. And what we've seen historically in the western U.S. is a very steep increase in the area burned year after year. There's always some variation, but overall there's a very clear upward trend. And we also know from recent scientific research that global warming has contributed to that increase in area burned by drying out the vegetation on the landscape through higher temperatures.
And I notice, we're not just seeing more acreage burned and bigger fires, but it seems like we're seeing more extreme fire behavior. I mean, we've seen fire crews just getting out of the way of some of these blazes. People use the term new normal to describe our 21st century climate of fire, if you will, as if we've reached kind of a hotter but stable climate system. But is it more accurate to think about our climate system's impacts as really accelerating as we continue to add greenhouse gases?
Well, so, new normal is a term that I'm comfortable with in general, in that we're now living in a different climate. With respect to wildfire in California, for example, it used to be that there was a well-defined wildfire season. Cal Fire is now, one of the groups that's using that term new normal. And the reason they're saying that is that it's now normal to have wildfires throughout the year. The new normal from their perspective is that there isn't an off season with regard to wildfire risk. And from a statistical sense, which is how I as a climate scientist would tend to define a new normal, we are now in a new climate. In California, it's a climate where the odds of warm years have increased substantially. We're now at the point where we're getting warmer than average conditions year after year. And what that means is we're also getting severe hot conditions much more frequently. What that means is that the vegetation is more dried out. The aridity of the fuel aridity, as is the technical term, that's been at record or near record levels in these fires. The Carr fire that's been happening in Redding over the last week, the Napa fires that occurred last fall in Northern California, the Southern California fires that occurred late last year, these all had near record fuel aridity. That's a result of the warming temperatures here in California.
So this climate that you talk about, the new climate, kind of what climate scientists have been predicting, really, higher sea levels, storm surges, more intense heat waves, and wildfires. But no, I'm kind of shocked at how quickly these impacts have arrived at just 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. What happens when we get to 2 or 3 degrees Celsius? 2 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit doesn't seem or sound like much to most people, but why is our climate system that sensitive?
So my research group had a paper in 2015, three years ago, about California drought. And when that paper came out, Andrew Revkin, who is now at ProPublica. He posted a illustration from a cover article that he had written in Discover magazine in 1988. I was in middle school in 1988. I was not doing climate research in 1988. And that illustration lays out, what Peter Glick was saying back in the 80s about California's climate, and in particular, the effect of temperature on floods and droughts in California. In California, we're very dependent on snowpack, as much of the western U.S. is. We rely on our snowpack for about 30% of our water storage, give or take. And what that means is we also rely on snowpack for flood control. So what Peter Glick was predicting back in the 80s was that as California warmed, the snowpack would become less reliable. We'd get more runoff in the winter, creating greater occurrence of episodes where our dams and reservoirs filled up and needed to release that water with greater flood risk. And then because of that lack of snowpack in the spring and summer, water deficits in the warm season coupled with higher temperatures. And this is exactly what has come to pass over the last 30 years. The interesting thing is in that illustration that Andrew Revkin shared, this future was 2050. That was the future that was laid out in this illustration. And we're seeing it unfold here in California, before even 2020. We have had about a degree Celsius of global warming. We're experiencing impacts already from that degree Celsius of global warming. If we get 2 degrees of global warming, like the United Nations has stated as a goal, we can expect further intensification of those impacts as that additional global warming unfolds.
And you talk about California. I mean, let's be real. California is already sort of a boom-bust climate, right? And now it seems like we're getting wet years. We build more fuels, quickly change to drought and heat. Isn't that only going to accelerate the fuel aridity and wildfire behavior going forward?
I live in California. I've lived in California most of my life, with the exception of a five-year stint in the Midwest when I was at Purdue University. I can tell you that California has a great climate. And it's a big reason we have such a vibrant agricultural sector. It's a big reason we have such a vibrant economy, a big reason we have such a large population and so many amazing different kinds of thriving ecosystems. So we have a wonderful climate here in California, and we have a climate that's changing. We have a climate that is already warmer than it used to be. It's a climate that, because of that warming, has a greater risk of protracted warm, dry periods compared to when our water system was designed and built 50 or 100 years ago. And at the same time, we're in a climate now where when we do get wet episodes, they're more likely to produce greater flood risk because of that lack of storage from snowpack. So the good news is that our leadership in California is very proactive about not only catching up with the climate change that's already happened, but getting ahead of the climate change that we will encounter in the future.
You work in extreme weather event attribution. What can we say about individual fire events like the ones we're seeing in California? Do you think we'll ever be able to assess a climate contribution to this extreme fire behavior?
Well, so that's something that our research group is working on literally right now. We submitted an abstract for a conference today, in fact. So it's an area of active research, not only in my research group, but also in a number of different research groups around the world. There's been a real explosion of research over the last 15 years or so to develop methods for testing hypotheses about ways in which global warming could influence individual extreme events. We have very robust results for hot events. Our research shows that the record hot event has been influenced by global warming at more than 80% of the globe when we look across the whole world. So there's already a clear fingerprint of global warming on extreme hot events. For wet and dry events, we find that human fingerprint at about half of the surface area where we have reliable observations. So we're already in a climate where individual events are being influenced by global warming. For wildfires, they are complex events and they arise from a confluence of different ingredients. The good news from a scientific perspective is we're able to analyze those ingredients individually and together. So we can kind of pull those different threads that come together to create an individual wildfire and ask questions, pose scientific hypotheses about each ingredient. A couple that we're interested in right now are this fuel aridity, you know, how much dry fuel is there on the landscape? How dry is it? And then also the winds, certainly in both those Napa fires, Southern California fires last year, those were situations where there were very strong winds from the regional atmospheric circulation. Interestingly, this Carr fire in the last week up in Redding is a case where it appears to be primarily a fuel-driven fire where there were very, very strong winds. Essentially, the descriptions and the signs of the wind damage essentially are what we would see in a tornado. But it wasn't really from the regional atmospheric circulation. It was from the intensity of the fire itself. So it's going to be interesting from a scientific point of view to compare and contrast these different events in a really systematic hypothesis-driven way. I realize that that's a little bit detached and objective from a scientific, as a scientific perspective. Certainly, our primary concern is with the families that are being affected by these disasters.
Sure, and it was phenomenal to look at the ambient synoptic scale winds, mostly under 10 miles an hour in the area, and then see that essentially EF1 or so tornadic-like damage from that rotating huge fire whirl. You talk with people about climate change all the time. I'm curious, what's the main message you want people to understand about what your work is telling us?
When I started graduate school back around 2000, in the Y2K era, people were just starting to detect impacts from climate change in very clear ways. But for the most part, climate change was an issue for the future. Global warming was already happening. It was clear that global warming was happening. But in terms of the local impacts, we had some anecdotal evidence. We had a couple systematic studies. But for the most part, most of the concern about global warming in terms of the impacts was what could happen in the future. And what we've seen very clearly over the last two decades is that, we are very clearly being impacted by climate change here and now. We're experiencing impacts on the coasts, inland, tops of mountains, in the ocean, in the tropics, at the poles, and all latitudes in between. The global warming that's already happened is already impacting people. It's impacting other living things. The good news is that we have opportunities to respond. We have opportunities to curb the extent of future global warming, and that's what the Paris Agreement has attempted to create an international goal to do. Here in the United States, the Clean Power Plan and other state level climate policies are aimed at that same goal. We also have opportunities to become more resilient, to catch up with the climate change that's already happened. We're clearly not adapted to the climate that we have now. We're experiencing climate and weather disasters around the country year after year. We're paying out more in damages now than we used to be, with a very steep trend. So we're not adapted to the climate of the present, but we have opportunities to become more resilient to the climate that we have now and also be prepared for the climate change that will occur in the future. So there's certainly hope. There's certainly reason for optimism. But that really is predicated on an acceptance that climate change is happening and that humans are the primary cause.
Noah Diffenbaugh, Earth System Science Professor at Stanford University, thanks for your work and for sharing your expertise today.
It's really been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
My name is Henry Jakubowski. I'm a chemistry professor at the College of St. Benedict, St. John's University. My specialty is biochemistry. It happened, I would say, in early 2017, when it was clear that environmental regulations were going to be starting to be rolled back. And I understand as a chemist and as an educator for 30 years that we have to act actually quickly if we want to decrease CO2 emissions and do something to save the climate. I felt like I needed to do something personally to inform people about the urgency of the situation, help them understand what's going on and what maybe can be done about it. So I became involved in an organization, a Citizens Climate Lobby. They gave me basically the agency in a way to go out, and I started giving a lot of talks to the Rotary Club, to the League of Women Voters, to church organizations. I appeared on local radio. And then the funny thing that happened was that at the same time, I realized that I had not done enough in my actual courses to talk about climate change. So when I realized that, I started, you know, every chance I could, we're going to talk about carbon dioxide, its properties, to suddenly start talking about its effect on basically global warming. On both those fronts, in the public and then back at the university, I felt like I had a vehicle now, I had a way, I had the urgency to move ahead and talk about this problem. It's really difficult for people to think about this problem. It's such a big problem. Any changes that we would ask people to make now won't be felt for a very long time. So there's no immediate payback for them. They feel overwhelmed by the issue. So in my talks, what I've done is scaled back the science that I talk about. I still do that, but I want to connect with them more at the emotional level. I do think that people are longing to come together on something. And, I mean, we're living in a pretty divisive time frame. But I do think that if everybody wants a healthy environment for their kids and grandchildren and they want a healthy planet, I see the barriers starting to fall, bringing people from different political persuasions together into some kind of common solution.
Let's face it, sometimes it's hard to visualize future climate changes. That's why one New York City artist started drawing lines of future sea level rise on neighborhood streets in New York. I asked artist Eve Mosher about the High Waterline project.
Originally, it started out as something where I wanted to put sculptures around the city, and then I thought, well, at the time, we could still sort of change the scenario, so I ended up drawing it in chalk, because the idea was that maybe this wouldn't be the impact.
And how many cities have you done this work in, these kind of projects?
I actually have to count. I did it myself in New York City, and I partnered with Heidi Quante and the communities in Miami and in Bristol in the UK. I worked with an institution in Philadelphia, and we worked with the community in Del Rey. And I have to say right now, I'm talking to a number of different organizations in D.C.
What's the reaction been? You paint these chalk lines on the street. You meet people. They're curious about what you're doing. What do they say to you?
Most often they're like, why are you putting blue chalk on the streets? What are you doing? That's a sports field marker. I used to push one of those around in a sports field. And it's a great way to open a conversation. And I explain, you know, this is the line that I'm drawing. In each city, it's different, you know, what the story is about the line. Or I know I'm not always the one saying it. The community people are saying it in the cities where they're drawing it. And they sort of explain, here's the sort of science behind it, and this is why we're drawing the line. And then that opens it up to being a conversation about sort of personal narratives. We're always like, well, what do you know about climate change? What's your experience been? Or where's your house? And we can have a conversation from there about climate change.
As a climate change communicator, I find your work fascinating. Is art a good form of communicating climate change data?
Yes.
Why?
I think it makes visible that which is hard to really relate to. You know, we can talk about this 10-foot above sea level line, but understanding, for instance, where that is in South Brooklyn is very different when you put it on the ground, when you put it in a very sort of visceral and place-based kind of marking way. Drawing lines is also a really powerful action. A lot of times it's used in a really bad way. In this case, it's hopefully used in a way that's building knowledge and power for communities.
How does art help understand science?
That's the zinger. you know, art is something that can give some emotional quality to science that isn't always there. I think scientists are getting better about telling the stories behind the science as well. But art has a way of bringing to it this visualization. It has a way of bringing to it relatable stories, and sometimes just a level of curiosity that doesn't exist when you're coming at it from a sort of science fact-based perspective.
You call yourself an artist and interventionist, I think, on your Twitter page. I love that. What do you mean by interventionist?
My work is meant to intervene in people's lives, in people's public spaces. and in their understanding of the city around them. So the idea is that the artwork doesn't exist in the hallowed halls of a gallery. It comes to you where you are and seeks to intervene in your daily life and your understanding.
Eve Mosher, New York City artist and interventionist, thanks for your work and your insight today.
Thank you, Paul.
Finally this week, it looks like Death Valley, California has set the record for the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. The average monthly temperature at Death Valley in July was just shy of 108 degrees. That breaks the old record of 107.4 degrees set last July. That's ClimateCast this week. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.